In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Yeah.
Let's all go to the
Time
lobby.
Time for us to talk movies. It's Let's Pass the Popcorn. Alan Adams of The Main Edge with us in studio. Hello, sir.
Hello. How are you?
I'm better now that you have brought in some of Sheridan's pepper jelly. I cannot wait.
Oh, yeah. You guys are going to have some fun with that. It is delicious. It's nice and spicy. Mix it up with a little cream cheese. Mm. Smear that on a cracker. Good stuff.
Love pepper jelly. We were going to trade grape jelly, but I told you we had a little problem in the production plant.
It happens. It absolutely happens.
Don't know. Something about it not setting properly.
Oh, I mean, I know it happens. I don't know why it happens how it happens. I just know that it happens.
The taste is good. It has the consistency, though. It's a little like honey right now, which is not really what you want with your jelly.
No, that's not necessarily what you're looking for.
But Abby's tweaking as
well,
we speak.
Well, and if you've got the taste right, like that's 95% of the battle right there. The rest is just like some science and math and bullcrap.
Right. I mean, it's not like we're not going to eat it.
Yes, no, I mean.
And I'm going to be sticking my finger right in there, but you know, do we want to share it with friends?
And that's the thing. Yeah. Yes, I totally understand.
But we will enjoy the heck out of this. Thank you to you and thank you to Sheridan.
Of course.
How was your weekend?
It was good. It was good. It was relatively uneventful, but good. You know. Got to see. The only time I really left the house was I went and saw a couple of movies. But other than that, like I was really pretty much battened down, like everybody else, mm-hmm. because you know it was basically it got all biblical out there for a good stretch.
I hope our friends the Kirkendalls have come up for air.
Oh man, like just look at that picture. It's like they're smiling, but there's something behind those smiles where you're just like, oh yeah.
Been there with the flooded basement. Oh, it's not fun.
Brutal. Yeah, like. We've been knock on wood very lucky with ours, but it's our basement was basically carved out of bedrock, so it's like it gets a little seepy bit in place, but it's not gonna like fill with water that's just not how it works. Again, knock on wood
indeed. All right, so you got to movies. How many did you see?
I saw three.
Excellent. Where do we begin?
Well, it's up to you guys. Would you like to go in ascending order of quality or descending order of quality? So do you want to close with the good one or do you want to close with the bad one?
Let's close with the good one.
Yes, but start with a bang because we always love hearing about the bad ones.
Well, if you've paid the least bit of attention to, the movie sphere over the last weekend or so.
Are we going to Dear Evan Hansen?
Indeed we are. where to start? First of all, this movie is based on a Tony-winning musical of the same name. It cleaned up the Tony Awards back in 2016, which, you know, by coincidence, the Tony Awards were last night, et cetera, et cetera. I wasn't really familiar with it beyond some basic understanding. And so when I came in, I didn't really have any sort of expectations. That's a good thing because I could not have gone in with a low enough bar for this movie to clear it. Just leaving aside the quality of the film itself, the basic premise is so bizarre and sociopathic that it was difficult for me to move beyond it. For those who are unfamiliar, Dear Evan Hansen, the basic gist is you have a young man named Evan Hansen who is... struggling with mental health. He's lonely. He's a bit of an outsider. And as part of his therapy, he's been assigned to write letters to himself. Well, due to circumstances, again, ridiculous, contrived circumstances, one of these letters winds up in the hands of another strange loner teen at his school named Connor Murphy. A few days later, it's tragic. Connor takes his own life, and the only thing he's got on him is this letter that he has taken from Evan Hansen. But since the letter is addressed to Evan Hansen, it's the parents of the young man who died basically are like, we didn't think our son had any friends. It turns out you're his friend. Tell us about your friendship. And rather than coming clean like a normal human, with normal human emotions and an understanding of social conventions, Evan Hansen just leans into the lie.
Yeah.
And really is just like, and starts making a bunch of stuff up. And of course, as lies do, spirals out of control. He winds up at the center of this sort of school organization built around helping, helping people deal with mental health. He does a speech that's actually a song at the young man's memorial service that goes viral, turns into a whole thing, and he starts dating the young man's sister. All of this is happening. Web of lies, expanding, and no one really learns any lessons at the end. Like, no real consequences are suffered. And so a lot about this really bothered me. All of this, by the way, is drastically, exponentially compounded by the fact that the person who played the lead in Dear Evan Hansen in 2016 won the Tony, Ben Platt, also plays Evan Hansen in the movie. Ben Platt is 27 years old.
Just turned 28. Yeah.
Could pass for 35. And when he does his cry face, it's like 45.
Oh.
And so you're like, you're sitting there and you're like, you're basically like all the weirdness of the premise is just ratcheted up because instead of seeing a teenager do these things, you're watching a grown adult man do these things. And there's this weird uncanny valley thing to it where it's just like you can't not see him as an adult moving among teenagers. And it just
and as somebody said to me, you know, when you had people in their late 20s playing teenagers in Greece, that was cute and campy, but it doesn't work for a show like this.
Well, but the thing is, like, it's the subject matter is very serious, and it's being directed by a man, Stephen Chbosky, who has a history of making these sorts of intimate, sort of indie, like teen dramas. And he tries to impose that sensibility on a musical, and it just does not work. And so you get these attempts at sort of, naturalism, realism, and then just periodically people start singing. And and you'll be shocked to find that doesn't really work very well. Again, it's so hard. At times it bordered on difficult to watch because, again, you're watching this grown man interact with people ostensibly in high school. And then you're watching as these, again, I can't stress enough, sociopathic actions that this young man is engaging in, like perpetuating a lie to the grieving parents of a dead teenager, like using that lie to somehow elevate oneself. And I know, like, we get the bits where he's racked with guilt and he's conflicted and all that stuff. Well, great. I mean, you're still doing all of these things, and again not a lot of lessons learned, not a lot of consequences suffered. And so you get something that really is almost unpleasant to watch.
So I'm curious, now it was tremendously successful on Broadway. What's lost in the translation? Why does it fail so miserably as a film?
Well, see, here's the thing. I think the stage is a lot more forgiving in basically all of the respects that I've sort of downplayed the film. I think it's a lot easier to accept older people playing younger people on stage. You don't have that sort of close up kind of, because here's the thing. Everyone in the movie is trying to play it like a screen actor. Like they're playing to a camera. Ben Platt's playing to the back of the house. Like, I mean, he's going full musical theater big. And it's jarring how just like in a completely different setting he seems to be. And again, like he's a talented enough guy. Like I think he's a good actor. He's a great singer. And I should say, the music in this movie is lovely. Like it really is wonderful music. And I understand why it proved popular, for those reasons. Again, I struggle to get past the basic storyline. And, you know, this is where I confess, and we've talked about this on a number of occasions on the air, I am a soft touch I am easily manipulated emotionally. And there are moments in this movie that definitely impacted me, like that definitely pushed those buttons. But, and this is a big but, I do not like it when I could see the strings being pulled. I do not like it when that that elicited emotion is not earned by the proceedings of the story, of whether it be a film, a book, a TV show, a stage show, what have you. And I resent it when that happens. And I really resented this movie because, again, like, I got emotionally engaged, you know, and I felt things, but I knew it was fake. And that's, and I think that that degree of sort of falsity is the biggest problem I had with all of this. I know there are almost certainly going to be people out there who vehemently disagree with this take, and that's okay. Like,
sure,
I don't have that relationship with the musical. I think if I was someone who did, I think my feelings might be different. Could this movie have been better with an actual teenager in the lead? I mean, probably, but I mean, I still have real problem with the fundamental premise, and I don't know how you get away from that.
So, dear Evan Hansen, Alan says, return to sender.
Yeah, just as a note, my review is written as a letter to dear Evan Hansen.
Is it really?
It is. Oh. It is titled, Dear Evan Hansen.
Oh, I can't wait.
So, enjoy that, folks.
All right. Two more to talk about. Stepping up in quality each time. What's in the middle this week?
So I saw a movie. It's a Netflix original. It's called The Starling. It's a dramedy of sorts. Stars Melissa McCarthy, Chris O'Dowd, Kevin Kline's in this movie, David Diggs shows up at one point. It's got a really good cast. It's a movie that I wanted to like, and it's not. How do I put this? It's a movie that makes the mistake of not earning its tonal inconsistency, if that makes sense. It's a movie that tries to be a very moving family drama for much of its runtime, but it's interspersed with these moments of sort of situational comedy and then full-on physical slapstick comedy. And those shifts are just, they can work in a movie, but in this one, they don't. It's just a little too jarring. The basic plot is you've got a family, a woman named Lily and her husband Jack. They're a happy couple, and they've just had a baby, and they seem like a pretty they seem pretty well adjusted and happy. We quickly move forward in time, we learn that Lily is now living in the house alone. Jack has been taken to a mental health facility, and it turns out that their young daughter, their baby, has passed away. And so Jack's struggles with that grief led him to being institutionalized, whereas Lily is sort of tamping down her feelings and trying to push forward as best she can. They interact periodically. There's a family visiting day every week, and they visit at the hospital, but there's still a lot of, you know, obviously a lot of unresolved tensions between them. And they're clearly both struggling emotionally. Against that, we see when Lily is at home, she's trying to figure out what to do. She decides, okay, like, I'm going to fix the lawn. I can control the lawn. I can control the garden. That's something I can do. So she goes out and starts doing that. And then... Well, then she gets attacked by a bird, the titular starling.
Oh, okay.
So, so there's a bird that's living in her yard and apparently doesn't want her to be in her own yard. And so periodically dive bombs her, like hits her in the head, knocks her down. Like it's a bit much. I'll put it that way. It's a bit much. We also have... The therapist at the hospital has told Lily, well, you should probably talk to someone. Here's some information for a former colleague of mine. You know, maybe he can help. She's like, okay, fine. She gears up her courage. She goes to find the guy. And the address she's been given is a veterinarian's office. She goes, and it turns out that this therapist's former colleague, the delightfully named Dr. Larry Fine... played by...
He's the same practice as Mo Howard, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Played by Kevin Kline, has apparently gotten out of the therapy game and become a veterinarian. Because that's a thing people do, right?
I'm sure, yeah.
That happens. Yeah. And so there's this sort of casual ongoing interaction, not quite therapy, but maybe therapy kind of relationship dynamic building between Lily and Dr. Fine. Basically we watch as, each of these two people struggles to make sense of what is ultimately a very senseless happening and try to reconnect with one another and try to find a way to continue living their lives, not the same because nothing will be the same, but to find a way forward. It's like if you took a Lifetime movie and then just every 15 minutes or so just dropped in like a Looney Tunes short.
Oh no.
Like that's how it felt watching this movie. And the thing is, it's so close to being good. Like if they had just, stuck with the more dramatic storyline. And, yes, there's room for humor. And obviously you want that sort of levity. It's kind of, to keep from it being overly dour. But you can't go too far in that direction. Right. Because otherwise it just feels silly. And it takes you out of the moment. And it just reminds you of the artifice of it all. Particularly when you're looking at a very clearly computer-generated bird doing bird stuff. It's a bummer because, first of all, I'm on record as liking Melissa McCarthy. I think she's talented. Mm-hmm. She and Chris O'Dowd have wonderful chemistry. Like the two of them very much click. And it's one of those things where it's like, man, I wish I was watching these two in a much better movie because there's something really there. And I hope this movie doesn't sort of torpedo that going forward. Cause I would love to see them take another shot at telling a story together, because again, they're both very talented, they're both very funny, but they both have the capacity for dramatic moments, and that's great. Then you've got Kevin Kline is here. Always love seeing Kevin Kline. Love me some Kevin Kline. It's a weird shtick that he's kind of been shoved into doing here. It's fine. Like he does his, it's fine. Yeah. He's doing his best, and he's obviously very talented. So it works for him. But I just wish he'd had a little bit more to do, I guess. And there are a couple of other really, talented people. Timothy Oliphant is in this movie. He plays Lily's, manager at the grocery store where she works. I mentioned David Diggs, who's an aide at the mental institution. But it's just like you have these wonderful, incredibly talented the actors, and you just sort of send them out there without really much to do. And so that really, that's kind of a bummer. Again, you've got to cast this good in a movie this flat. It just feels like a missed opportunity. And I'm not gonna this movie's not actively terrible. I think I'm most affected by the fact that it just feels like with just a little shift here or there, it could have been really good. And and that feeling of missed opportunity, it just bums me out.
All right, and what's the third and best film that you saw?
So I was really delighted to see that this movie actually appeared in theaters here, because I knew it had gone into limited release the previous weekend, and I was concerned that I wouldn't get a chance to see it. It's a movie called The Card Counter. It's the latest one from writer-director Paul Schrader, stars Oscar Isaac, it was excellent. Like, very much a throwback kind of movie. Look, I'm a sucker for movies about gambling. Like, I love gambling movies. I love movies about gambling. I love movies about gamblers. And I love that dynamic on screen. And I think Oscar Isaac is one of the most talented actors of his generation. And so seeing him tackle the sort of prestige dirtbag kind of role, the sort of thing that Schrader excels at creating, was a real delight. So the basic gist is Isaac plays a guy named William Tell. I'll leave it to you to discover whether or not that's an alias. He is a professional gambler, but not like a high end on TV kind of professional gambler. Like, he's a grinder, because again, he is, as the title suggests, a card counter. That is something that casinos don't care for. For those who are unclear, counting cards is basically a way in which you can sort of negate the house advantage when playing blackjack. It's a relatively simple system, and just boils down to you keeping track of what cards have been played and what cards remain in the deck and betting accordingly. It's not illegal per se, but it is very much frowned upon by casino management. And so... What William does is he wins just enough to make a living, but not so much as to invite unwanted attention from the various pit bosses at these casinos that he frequents. Because he drives from place to place and sort of does it that way rather than setting up shop in a singular spot. But it all kind of shifts for him. We learn that he is an ex-con. He has spent a number of years in prison, military prison, because, as it turns out, William Tell is one of the soldiers who was prosecuted for the we'll euphemize it the way they do it in the movie, enhanced interrogation of enemy combatants at Abu Ghraib.
Wow.
So I did not know that. I thought this was just a gambling movie, and to have this sort of added element, but it was in prison that he learned how to count cards. So he has this history. And so, you know, you've got a guy really dealing with, internalizing, a lot of bad stuff from his past. And, you know, the movie kind of asks you to question, you know, how much of who we are is defined by what we've done, et cetera, et cetera. But so William is at a casino that happens to be hosting a security convention, and he goes in to see a former military guy by the name of John Gordo, played by the great Willem Dafoe. He goes in, watches a little bit of the speech, leaves. He's followed out by a young man named Kirk, played by Ty Sheridan. As it turns out, Kirk's dad was also one of the soldiers prosecuted for those actions. William doesn't know him, but feels an obligation to this kid to sort of help him deal with his trauma. Now, the kid's plan is he wants to take his revenge directly on John Gordo, whereas William tries to encourage him, well, why don't you come with me and hang out, and we'll sort of spend some time together. I'll show you a little bit more of the country, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, William has been recruited to join sort of gambling stable of a matchmaker by the name of Lalinda, played by just an absolutely wonderful turn by Tiffany Haddish, who's great.
Hmm.
So you have these two people who have sort of entered his orbit. You know, he's so used to this solitary existence, and now he has these two new people in his world. And how does that impact the way he lives his life? How does that impact the way he performs at the table, et cetera, et cetera? And we watch as these relationships grow and shift and change, and he's left to try and decide what his priorities are, both now in the moment and going forward. And as it turns out, he's still someone who's ready to make some hard choices that I won't go into specifics, but it gets pretty gnarly in some spots.
Interesting.
It's really good. Like,
that's not what I expected from it, I guess.
You know, and me neither, but it's remarkable because it's very much a tour de force type performance, from Oscar Isaac, who, spends a lot of time like solo on screen. He's so magnetic, and he's able to do and say so much without using words that it's just that he's just so compelling to watch. And then you combine Schrader's, you know, sort of thematic continuity with the idea of writers and writing. Like, he's got there are a number of scenes where we see William writing in a journal, and we get voiceover talking about the various things, whether it's about his time in prison or his time in Abu Ghraib or his, you know, relationships with the people in both of those places and the relationships he has now. Like, it's just, it's this wonderful sort of device. Doesn't always, like, it doesn't always work when people try to do that in movies, but here it really clicks. And I think it's because Schrader is such an old school kind of director. Because, I mean, we're talking about a guy who goes back to the New Hollywood days. Like, right. Like Paul Schrader wrote Raging Bull. Like, he wrote Taxi Driver. Like, this is a guy who's been doing it for a very long time. And it should be noted that Martin Scorsese is a producer on this film. But just watching it, it feels like one of those, like, late 70s type movies. Like, just even from, like, stylistically, like, just instead of cuts, we get a lot of, like, fade to black, fade up, you know, like, stuff like that. Stuff you remember from those old school movies that you just don't see anymore. And, you know, the pacing, you know, he takes his time in a way that you don't necessarily see that much in 21st century filmmaking. It's not going to be for everyone. And it gets, like I said, it gets kind of graphic. It gets pretty intense in some spots. And if you don't think you're ready for that, I would say you might want to steer clear. But it is just the performances. Isaac is great. Tiffany Haddish is great. Ty Sheridan, like, he's like a half step behind, but there's no shame in that. Like, when you're talking about these people, and Defoe, like, he only has a handful of scenes, but man, doesn't that guy know how to turn it up?
He's so good.
Just like, again, like, I loved this movie, but I can't stress enough, your mileage may vary.
Alan Adams talking movies with us, three to choose from, different thoughts on each one there. Alan has given you the information you need. You proceed at your own risk.
Yes, I've done my part. Now you do yours.
Thanks, Alan.
My pleasure.
We'll catch you on Wednesday. Alan Adams on Downtown.